accession number 18452, reel 1.
Mrs. Shipstone, reel 1.
Shh.
Where were you born, please?
I was born in Amsterdam.
Do you remember, were you living in Amsterdam when war was declared? When war broke out?
My parents went to Eindhoven. My father worked for Philips. And so they went to Eindhoven when I was very small. And so I lived most of my life in Eindhoven.
So your hometown really is Eindhoven, Amsterdam.
Not Amsterdam. I was only born in Amsterdam.
And you went to school in Eindhoven?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember when the Germans attacked the Netherlands?
Yes, very much so. I saw them coming into Eindhoven, but their first attack actually was an air attack on Rotterdam. That was the first time. And a son of a friend of my parents, who was a doctor, or a student doctor, was in there, and he was killed. And that I remember very, very well, in this air attack. Yes.
What was your own first experience of the German attack?
Well, we saw them coming into town, and we felt such an extraordinary anger looking at these people, the tanks, and it looked as if they really had emptied the prisons. I remember the look on their faces and these horrible helmets, that I remember well, yes.
Was there any fighting in Eindhoven in 1940?
No, they came through. In fact, they had come through from France, and then they just came through to Eindhoven. Not really any fighting, no, not.
Had the German attack taken you and your family by surprise, or had you expected it?
No, I think we were expecting them to come through. You know, just we heard Hitler on the radio many, many times. And in fact, yes, I think it was not unexpected, no.
What was your address in Eindhoven at that time?
The house was called Sonnehoek. And we lived in the Zeelse Straat, and I can't remember the number. It was very close to an airfield, so the airfield became occupied. And in fact, just before Christmas, our house was being commandeered by the commandant of the German Air Force. And I'm one of a large family. We had 7 children, father, mother, and a maid living in, and an uncle and aunt who came from Amsterdam, because the north fell first. You see, we were occupied later. They came to us when Amsterdam had fallen, and they had no children. So with lots of ration books, we felt that it was better for them to be with us. So and then when the house was commandeered, we were terrible. We didn't know where to go. And it was just before Christmas. And in fact, it didn't happen because the German commandant, whoever he was, decided it was too dangerous, it was too close to the airfield, because the airfield was always prone to attacks.
How did the Germans behave at first when they first occupied Eindhoven?
Well, we don't know. We never talked to them. But we had a dog. And then we said, "Where's Hitler?" He would just chase down the garden to the front gate and bite the first German that came along. He couldn't stand the leather coats and the jack boots. And he used to come and call at our door and say to Mother, "Look what your dog has done." And Mother would say, "Oh, sorry, I can't speak German in Dutch," and sort of say, "Oh." So they threatened to kill our dog, but he never did.
Did your family speak German, in fact?
Of course. Yes, of course. We all had learned it at school, yes. We had, that might amuse you. We had a radio, because we were not allowed to listen to the Dutch radio. And so we had a radio, which we kept in that dog's kennel. So whenever Germans came to look at our house, that they wouldn't go near the dog because it was so anti-German. And also, we had people from around us coming to listen in our house to Radio Engeland. And that was one of the things, because eventually my father was imprisoned by the Germans, and so was my brother.
How did it come about that your father and brother were in
prison? Well, because somebody must have known that we gave them, gave people. Oh, father also handed out underground literature called Vrij Nederland, and so, but we were very anti-German, and that was very well known. So there were.
Were you there when your father was arrested?
No, father was at a conference in town, and he didn't come back, and somebody phoned and said my father had been taken to the police station, and then they came for my brother, and he, my youngest brother, who also used to help with people that went underground, you know, with ration books and things like that. We all did, actually, in fact.
Did you know about the anti-German activities of your father and brother?
Yeah, of course. We didn't really know anybody that wasn't anti-German. Yes.
Was there anybody in your neighborhood who had a different opinion about the Germans?
No, yeah. No, nobody.
Did you get involved in any anti-German or resistance activity yourself?
Yes, I used to look after a chap who was underground at some farm, and I used to cycle to this farm to get him ration books, which my brother used to be able to get from somewhere, I don't know where. Yes, well, we all did our bit.
Did you see any anti-German leaflets or propaganda yourself?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Under what circumstances did you see?
Well, my father used to get them from somewhere, and everybody did a bit like that. It was nothing out of the ordinary, but yes, it was called Vrij Nederland, and it used to have the proper news, because we didn't get any proper news, because it was always full of German propaganda.
Was he receiving just one or two copies, or receiving
lots
of copies?
Yeah, no, few to hand out to people, because everybody wanted to know.
Did you hand out the leaflets yourself?
No, no.
What did your mother think about what you and your father and brother were doing?
Oh, she thought it was perfectly all right.
But wasn't she worried about the risk?
No. No, no.
Why not?
I don't know why. I don't know. I mean, she had other worries. She had worries how to produce food for us all, I suppose. She had actually, when father went to Germany, was taken prisoner, and my brother, she had a horrible time, really, because she didn't know whether they weren't going to be shot, because every time people pushed the odd German in canals or something, you know, some of the hostages, as they were called, used to be shot. So that was a great worry, yes.
Did your father and brother have a trial?
Yes. And they had to go to The Hague. It was at the time of at the time of Seyss Inquart. He was the whatever, the Gauleiter or whatever he was called, and they were sentenced to 6 months in jail, but they had more than 6 months in jail, so there was nothing there. So that was what it was, for delivering illegal literature and doing illegal things that we shouldn't do.
Did you attend the trial yourself?
No, no, we didn't.
Were you allowed to?
No, I don't think so. But my father and my brother were held in Sertogenbosch, and because people knew us, we knew police that were friendly to us and would say, well, they're going to be in a train to Haren, which was the camp where the hostages were held. And so we travelled in the train, and we had some sausages and bits and pieces, and because they were under escort of a policeman, a Dutch policeman. And so we gave these things. And I remember my father putting a long sausage in his sock, because they weren't fed very well. But, you know, that's because we had a friendly policeman. And so that we did that, which was quite exciting. I mean, we found it all rather exciting, the whole thing.
Which year was he arrested? Were they arrested in?
Oh, yeah. 43. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I don't know.
Did you get any Allied bombing in your area?
Oh, yes. The Phillips Works were very badly bombed, you know, because the Phillips Works, well, Eindhoven, you don't know any about Eindhoven at its heyday, had about 60,000 people working at the Phillips Works. And though Phillips, my father knew the Phillipses, and they were terribly anti-German, but they couldn't do anything else. They had to keep their factory going. They had to produce things for the German Wehrmacht, I suppose, what if Wehrmacht or something, but they had. But they were bombed by the Allied on, I think that was in 45, and actually an enormous amount of, I was in town, I happened to be in town on a bicycle, because we couldn't have cars, and Eindhoven was very badly bombed, and the bombing was so low, the bombs went in sideways. I can still, not from the top, but that was the Allied bombing, mainly British, I think. There's so many memories coming back. And I think quite a lot of people were wounded and killed, because Eindhoven is really Phillips, the Phillips Works all around there.
Did any bombs fall near you?
No. Well, when they finally bombed the airfield, we had large windows in our house, all the big windows were shattered, but not the house was not bombed, no. Oh, I must tell you about the same dog. If an air raid, an English air raid was coming, John would never believe this, it was coming, the dog was always nervous, long before it happened, and then we knew we had to go into the cellars to really wait for the bombers to come. Yes.
And when the Allied advance occurred after D-Day, what do you remember about the coming of the Allied soldiers into your area?
Oh, very much, because, well, first I saw the planes coming with their gliders all coming down, and we were so excited to be liberated. They came in September, and my own home had a big orchard, and it was the time of the peaches, and we had big buckets with peaches standing at the farm gate, and we would throw them into the tanks. It was really, and all three of my brothers went as interpreters. My youngest brother went, I can't remember exactly who, but my second brother went with the Scottish regiment, and my eldest brother went with the Blues. What are the Blues, John?
Those are the cavalry.
Yes,
the Guards,
I remember,
cavalry.
Yes. And he went from our, we could see it from our house, from our front gate, and he went into one of those armored cars, and at the same time, a German motorbike with two Germans on it came by and stopped and started shooting at this armored car. And my brother, was of course in civilian clothes because he'd just gone with them, fell into the car, and then they all drove off. So my mother was absolutely beside herself. And this was on the advance to Arnhem. And we got my brother's watch back about 10 days later. He sent it back, but he was safe, and he was near Arnhem. That's where he was. Yes.
Was there any dangerous fighting in your vicinity when the Allies advanced?
No. Well, they were further up, but I don't think there was any dangerous fighting. No, they came through Eindhoven fairly quickly because once they got through France and through Belgium, we are very close to the Belgian border, they were then on their way to Arnhem, to Nijmegen, actually.
Had there been any Jews living in your area?
Yes.
What happened to them?
Well, they disappeared. First they had to wear the Star of David, and then in the end they disappeared to camps in Germany.
Did you know any of them personally?
Yes.
Did you see them taken away?
No, no. But you heard. And actually, that there again, a burgomaster who is a relation of my, you know, my brother's future wife, actually, he was taken away because I suppose of anti-German activities, and he's never been heard of since. He was a father of God knows 4 or 5 children. I don't know what happened to him.
Did you know much about what was going to happen to the Jews who were taken away?
Yes, yes. Yes. But what eventually happened, you know, you didn't know how awful it was. But, you know, when they were taken away, that was really pretty awful.
During the German occupation, did you listen to BBC?
All the time. This radio that we had hidden in the roof of our kennel of our dog, yes.
When did you listen to it? What time?
Well, usually it's 7 o'clock. 6 or 7 o'clock, it was the evening news, yes.
And was it in English or in Dutch?
In Dutch.
Special Dutch program?
Yes.
Was it useful for you to be able to get...
Oh, absolutely, I mean, yes.
How was it introduced, do you remember?
Yeah, here is Radio Engeland, Radio Vrij Nederland. Here is Radio Vrij Nederland, that's what he said.
Did you know any of the people who spoke on it?
No.
Well, how dangerous was it listening to...
Well, it was dangerous if they knew you did. This is all part of the thing. I suppose that's why my father was picked up. But as one was young, you know, you felt you were doing your bit and it was exciting.
What was your standard of life like and feeding like during the occupation?
Well, at its lowest, I think our calories were 1,200 per person per day. 1,200 calories, food in value off. It was very difficult. But that's another interesting thing. My mother remembered the First World War, and she knew that sunlight soap was a very good thing to have. And so before, actually when sort of war was imminent, she used to buy sunlight soap. And we had a cellar under her house, and she had masses of bars of sunlight soap. And because farmers are always frightfully clean, at least the farmers in Holland are, we used to cycle about, we all took it in turn, but I remember going practically every week sort of to a little path to farms about 20 kilometers away, and for one bar of sunlight soap, a double bar, you know, I don't think you can remember them, we used to get 1 liter of milk, 1 loaf of bread, and 1/2 pound of butter. Well, that made a great deal of difference to one's rations, of course. And we did that, you know, as long as the bars of soap lasted.
Did they last, or did you
run
out?
Yeah, we ran out in the end, yes. But, yes.
So, in the end, what were you living on?
Well, very little. There were 12 in our house. And, this aunt we had in the Dutch aunt from Amsterdam, she used to know all these lovely things she could make with flower bulbs, you know, and that sort of thing, and making little bits out of that. Well, we had our bread. We used to have, say, 2 slices each or something. You know, it was rationed very much, so you had to be very careful. It wasn't easy.
When you say flower bulbs, do you mean like tulip and daffodil bulbs?
Yes.
What do they taste like?
I can't remember now. And we always said, oh, it was delicious. I can't remember.
What happened to you after the war? I think you did a special job in Germany?
Yes. I went in soon after 45, 46. I was phoned by a friend of mine, and she said, you can speak German and you can speak English, can't you? I've got somebody here who's looking for somebody that can speak German and English. Would you like to go to Germany? And I said, doing what? She said, I'm not sure, but it is for something called UNRWA. This was the United Nations. So I said to my mother, can I go? And she said, well, if I say no, you'll always feel you've missed out. So I went.
What was the job?
The job was, it evolved. Our headquarters was in Iserlohn, and that's where I went. But it was just soon after. There were still Russian prisoners of war in camps. I could hear them singing at night. It was very early after the war had ended. And my job became, first of all, I started off by visiting DP camps. And then it sort of, there was a thing in the American, I'm putting this very badly, but in the American press that quite a lot of children were lost during the war, and they were taken by Germans and being made into little Nazis and all the rest of it. And the idea was that we would go to orphanages and families that had children of Allied nationalities. They had to give these names of the children to the Kreisleiters or whatever they were called. And then we would find out where the child came from and then probably reunite it with its family. That was the idea. And so one set off. And when you found a child if you found them in an orphanage, you didn't have really any worries. Well, I wasn't all that old, and I felt I was playing God. And then if it was a Polish child, you got it out of the orphanage, and it went to a children's home in Bad Liebspringer, I think, yes. And from there, the trains went, several people did this. But if it was in a German family, and even though I wasn't terribly thrilled with any Germans, if it was well cared for, it was loved, and if it turned out that you didn't really know where the parents were, and then, one thought, are you doing the right thing sending it back to Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, what's happening there? And very often you didn't really feel, I personally felt, it was difficult to make that decision. And would you like to hear a special story about this? I went once to, what was the place? It was very badly bombed, just on the Rhine. In fact, I had my car and I had a driver, and we used to go to, it was terribly badly bombed, a place on the Rhine.
Cologne?
No, it was.
Dusseldorf?
No.
Duisburg?
No, they were all terribly badly bombed, but
Essen?
It was near Essen, but God, I wish I could give you the name.
Never mind.
It was just over the border, and we couldn't find the house because it was badly bombed. But anyway, we sort of looked at it. I had the address, and there I came, and it was underground in a cellar. It was an elderly woman. She might have been more than 40, 45, but to me she seemed rather old. A young girl and this small child. So I had a questionnaire, and I had to ask, who's the mother? And the young girl said she was the mother. And then I said, who's the father? And the elderly woman said, my husband, the German elderly woman. The girl was Latvian. So I said, oh? And she said, yes, we couldn't have any children. And my husband was on the Ostfront. And he asked me if I would mind if he had a child by this young girl. And I said, yes, and here she is with the child. And I hope, and the war is a bit further back, that we can adopt both. And the man was still at the front. He hadn't come back yet. So that was quite an amazing thing. So I lost that case. I never did anything about that. But there were several things that are very, very, very difficult to decide. But what you do with the child that you find. I found one Belgian child. Is this going to be too long?
No, carry on.
One Belgian child in an orphanage in Ziegen, right in the Harz Mountain. And he was about seven.
I think you just remembered that the name of the town where the husband had fathered a child was Emmerich.
Emmerich, yes.
But you were telling me a story about Ziegen, if you can go back to that.
Well, I'll go back there. I found this boy. He was about 7 years old, and he had a Belgian name. And the nuns didn't know anything about his background. But he said he thought he lived very close to Antwerp, and he named a very mentioned a very strange name, something like Capella or something. Anyway, and he thought his father had a bakery, but he was only 7 and he had been there 2 years maybe. Anyway, so I went on leave after that, back to Holland, and I thought, I wonder whether I could find that child's father. So I looked on a map near Antwerp, something with Capella, and there it was. It was called Ulrich's Capella. So I thought, well, there can't be very many bakeries. It's a small place. So I went and met my brother-in-law, actually, to Belgium, and found Ulrich's Capella and found a bakery. And there was an elderly man, and I said, have you lost a child during the war? He said, no, but it's my grandson that we've lost. And it happened that the father and this child's mother had both been collaborators of the Germans, and they were offered a holiday for children in Germany. So the child went to Germany, then they started bombing the place, so the place moved on, and it finally ended up in this orphanage in Siegen. And there he was. And there again, not a very satisfactory ending, because the father was imprisoned because having been pro-German, and the mother was one of the ones that had her hair cut off because she'd been collaborating with Germans. But in fact, that child finally went back, and what happened to it then, I don't know. That wasn't my job.
Any other individual cases you remember?
I don't think I can. These are my special ones, I think. I just work quite a lot. But
how much do you think you were able to achieve?
Not too much. I think that's why, in the end, I think I gave up, because it was pretty heartbreaking at times. You know, you found these children, and because they were small, and you took them back to a children's home in either Bad Liebspring or Paderborn, never mind. And, you know, they treated you as if you were their mother, and I found it very hard. So what was the future? I don't know what happened to them. I don't know.
But you were based at Iserlohn?
Iserlohn, yes.
Where's that?
That is in the... Oh, I can tell you another wonderful story. Shall I tell him the story of Fanny Becker?
Good story. Do
you want to hear it? Or?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Well, it's in the Ruhr. It's actually quite a nice place in the Ruhr. But when we first went to Iserlohn, when I was picked up by this lady who was already in Andra, and she took me there, because I could speak German, I had to help, get the houses, get the accommodation, you know, to commandeer the accommodation. And we ended up in Südstrasse in Iserlohn. And there lived a very large house, Herr and Frau Niebecker. He had been an industrialist in the Ruhr, and she was an Austrian. Anyway, we got that big house, and they were allowed to stay in the attic. The attic was quite big, so they made that quite, and were obviously well off Germans. And Herr and Frau Niebecker lived in the attic whilst we lived in the big house. And one day, Frau Niebecker came to me and she said, you know, I was in England just before the war. I was married to a surgeon called Freddy somebody or other, I can't remember his name. And we were staying with the Walkers in Troon. And the Whiskey Walkers in Troon. So, and because war was...